Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMel with you with The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. And today we have in the studio with us two wonderful people. So, with us today, Stephanie Roth. Stephanie, welcome back to WBAI. Stephanie is my associate here at the DeMel Center, and happy to be in here.
Yes, I am happy to be in here. Thank you.
And also with us is Alan White, newfound friend and associate. Alan is kind of a remarkable man. Alan, welcome to the airwaves of BAI. Oh, you've been on the airwaves before, right?
Right.
But you're welcome to the Positive Mind.
Thank you, Armand.
Yeah. Hey, so listen, let's start this off. What we're going to talk about today, it just touched me over the holidays. I saw so many people in so many age groups and so many generational matches that seemed new to me. You know, I saw people, parents, great-grandparents now existing with their children who are the grandparents, existing with the parents, existing with their children. So now four generations getting together, four people, you know, I mean, people are living older.
Right.
And if you're lucky, they live older and they're in good shape and they could have a nice time together.
Yeah.
However, one of the things that happen is sometimes you're trying to be with somebody who is an older parent and the parents, you know, have gone through different stages. Now, Stephanie defines four stages of parenting. Go ahead, Stephanie. How do you see it?
So stage one is the young parent, a parent when they first have their kid. Stage two, and then until their child's grown through adolescence and everything. And then stage two is the empty nest, once the children leave the home. But you're still a parent. You're still in constant contact with
and you're taking
children.
Care of them because they still need to write home for money and mom lonely and stuff like that.
Dear. And they need somewhere to go on college break, and that's still home. So, and then there's the parent of adult children, which is also the stage where most people become grandparents. That's the third stage. And the fourth stage, which we're going to be talking about today, is the declining parent, when your parent becomes elderly and starts to get ill and develop some illnesses that are more prone for elderly adults.
So we've got four stages. We've got the young parent, we've got the empty nest parent, which is you're a parent without being a parent because your kid is just living somewhere else. And then you got this other stage where you're the parent without a child because your child is grown and they have a family of their own.
Right.
So then you and your husband are supposedly celebrating at this point and going on vacation and retiring, getting in your 50s, 60s. But then comes the fourth stage, and part of the way that this whole show came about, which is when you have a parent who has some declining facilities. Things start falling down, you know?
And often they need you. This is when the parents need their children to begin taking care of them. They need some extra help, some extra love, some extra support.
Well, you see, that's where I think the fear is. I wonder if that's need or if the children perceive need and therefore they stay away. So let me take a look at that with Alan White. Alan White.
That's me.
I know. I was just thinking about the Institute. Alan, what happens? What happens with parents as they get older? Now, there's a couple of things. Let's talk about a person who is looking at their parents, and if we want to start with the extreme, let's look at the extreme of having a parent with dementia,
right,
or having two parents with dementia.
Right. The adult child who has left the house and is building their own family, has their spouse and their children and their profession, their life is packed with activity, with needs, with goals. They left their home and they expected that they would be autonomous and that they would stay autonomous and that their parents would be taking care of themselves as their parent has always done as they were growing up. Now they look back to the homestead, to the parents that are supposed to be self-sufficient, hopefully are self-sufficient, are now declining to a stage where they need some type of support from the child.
Well, now I want to go back on that question, Alan, because I hear what you're saying. But I'm going to rephrase that. They could use support from the child, because the truth of it is, if the kids move to Saudi Arabia, why would kids move to Saudi Arabia? They move to the moon. Those parents would have to take care of each other. Those two elderly parents would have to take care of each other. I think they could use the help.
Right. They could use it.
And but need is a different thing. They need help maybe to get upstairs, but if they can't get the help, they wind up with getting programs, you know, and things
right.
like that.
Adult daycare or an outside person to come into the house and assist with some home needs, some cooking needs, some health aid needs.
And those are available. The fact that parents, that children perceive that their parents have needs that should be met by the children, I think is part of the problem, because I think the children, when they hear need, they feel guilt.
An obligation.
An obligation.
And there's a fear that comes in there.
So let's take it from not that your parent needs your help, but
they want your help.
Or could use a little
or
help.
Or could use a
they
little
just
help.
Because I've seen parents who don't want any help at all.
A lot of times, a lot of parents will be very reluctant to call on their children for help. They'll still be in the mindset of being self-sufficient. And no matter if their body is declining, it's very hard-pressed for them to admit that their body is declining or that they do depend on someone else. So there may be a need present, but the parent themselves might not acknowledge that.
And might not also a parent not acknowledge a need because they don't want to lay the burden on their kids?
Right. And a lot of children, I think, are afraid that if their parent does take the different tack, as in, I do need you, that guilt will come. And that obligation will be pressed on the child when the child is, we're talking about the adult child with responsibilities, will be drawn away from their goals, their needs, their responsibilities to take care of a parent out of guilt.
We're talking with a remarkable man here, Alan White, because I've been speaking to Alan White. You know what he does? He services elderly people. I mean, he goes to elderly people, and he goes to the children of elderly people, and they come to him, and they consult with him about how to engender their own or wake up their own compassion. Because it's very hard to be compassionate for when you have an elderly parent who is Alzheimer's, for example, or when one has it or both have it, which we'll also talk about. And it's like, this is where Alan steps in. Alan steps in the middle of it. Alan says, has a definition of caregiving that I think is kind of fascinating. And both Stephanie and I were talking to him before and had this kind of fascination for the way you were describing it. Talk to me about caretaking
and caregiving
of the elderly. Talk about that, because I'm going to use the word elderly because I don't have better words for
right.
it. But we'll start with Rite Aid. Go ahead.
Right. It's caregiving is two words, really. The first word being care, which is a courtesy or a service that you would give a fellow man. It doesn't need to be as involved as medical attention or anything that you might need some training in. It can be just as simple as saying hello to someone on a line when they're waiting for their prescription. And the fact that you have given it makes you a caregiver. So the phrase is in the medical profession for home health aides. You can term them as caregivers, and it's a very generous way to describe, because if a person is in, like, picture your own parent. Let's say you have a parent that is in need of getting care from a home health aide. You want to believe that they are giving your parent care. So if you use that term for the home health aide, you're engendering the kind of performance that you would like to have for your parent. But it also comes with a stigma that if you are a caregiver, you have to be dedicated to this. You have to be in for the long haul, and you have to put a lot of energy forth to be a caregiver. But I'm suggesting that being a caregiver is just as simple as saying hello to someone, giving them a common courtesy that we all really are looking for, but more elderly people feeling maybe separated from the daily, maybe shunted off as not relevant anymore in our society, is maybe just a little bit more seeking for that kind of care.
We're speaking with Alan White, who works with the elderly and the children of the elderly and helping to get some kind of communication. You say something kind of remarkable. People often wonder where they could volunteer their services. But you know, Alan, you walk down the street, and if you acknowledge someone who looks like they feel insignificant in the world, like the elderly. Now, when someone is over 75 years old or 70 years old and they're walking around the city and they got brittle bones, one thing they don't want to do is get noticed. Part of not getting noticed is I don't want to get hit. I don't want to get banged over. I can't handle myself. I don't want somebody to take my money. So there's a natural kind of caution that goes with somebody who feels vulnerable and brittle when they walk down the street. They try not to make eye contact because they're afraid of what you might think. If you're an older man, you're afraid you might be thinking of having sexual thoughts. If you're an older woman, you're afraid that you might be inviting somebody to in some way exploit you. Therefore, they have glancing eyes. However, every time I've walked down the street and I've seen someone who is old enough to be my parent, I smile. I smile just because I want to go back to what you said a little earlier about the appreciation. We're going to go to that. And that smile seems to make a difference. Now, what does it do?
It's such a simple gesture that telegraphs so much. It's just a smile. Tells the person that you're smiling to that I see you, I acknowledge you as a person, and I appreciate you as a person. It's just that simple. It doesn't cost anything to give that.
Well, you do something else. I mean, you have an attitude towards somebody who is, if you met somebody 80 years old, you talked about your fascination before. Can you talk about that?
Well, we know how old the city is, right? I want to illustrate that with an experience I had yesterday. I went to a coffee house because I do a lot of writing, and I like to get out of my place and go into a place that's just a little bit different. It's almost, I call it like it's an office that I use for writing. But it was Christmas Day, so it's very, very crowded. So there was a huge population, very diverse around me. In my local area of the coffee house, a woman came in with an elderly person. Now, I don't know if they were mother and daughter. The woman herself, she might have been in her 60s, so it's possible that they were mother and daughter, but the woman called her by her first name, which still could be a mother and daughter relationship. But the line was long, so she went to the line, and she sat her mom or this elderly person, her companion, down to wait for her. And I looked at her, and out of the window is a building there that only existed for maybe 5 years. So I remember myself what that area was like 5 years prior to that building being built. And as I looked at this woman, I wondered what was her memories of not only that area, but all the areas that she'd ever been in. What was her history? What was life like in her lifetime? And just the potential opened up for a new experience of the world I live in and in my society through the life embodied of this woman. So age to me represents history. And it's an encapsulation of history that you can tap into at any time, because if they want conversation with you, they will share so much that can enhance your life.
Well, there's that. And, of course, you know, there's this other problem. I remember hearing this from somebody yesterday who Steve Buscemi made a little private movie. I think it was called The Interview. And in his movie, he said, as I was getting older, I noticed how I embellish all my stories. And he said, I'm beginning to embellish more and more, and I know this is part of being older. And that's what happens. You know, part of when you listen to somebody talk about their stories, they believe that they have to keep your interest a little further. And so the stories get embellished. Mm-hmm. And they get embellished to hold your attention. But after a while, you listen to the story upon story upon story, and you don't want to be there that long because you're hearing them. So the information is not the stories. The information is something else.
It's locked in their life.
It's locked
in.
It's
who they are.
It's such a jewel. I see somebody who is 75 or 80 years old, and I look at them, and then I look at another thing that I keep on my desk. I keep a rock that's over 1,000 years old or 1,000,000 years old or something. I give more regard to that rock because I appreciate its beauty and its age. But there, right in front of you, is a human who's lived so long. So let's say you're the average therapist in her 20s or his 20s, and you have a fascinating older person you're treating. Instead of treating them like, you know, just somebody you have to take care of and get by, think of what information is available inside there. Think of not only how you could use it for your own life, but the beauty of this story. How did that person get to be where they are?
Exactly.
How did you get it? How did you make it this far? You know, how did you get this far? How did you get to this point? And maybe you can't answer it, so all I'm going to do is be able to admire the fact that you're here.
And helping them identify those factors that got them to that point.
Well, how do you do that?
By doing exactly what you said, by asking.
Well, give me an example. Give me an example of what you might ask somebody who may be, let's say you have somebody who's got dementia, okay, Alzheimer's, a growing disease because we're recognizing it more, because people are living longer, mm-hmm. because it's now identifiable,
right?
And you deal with the parent who's got this mind that's kind of lost.
Right. If I'm the therapist meeting them for the first time, as with any patient, any client, I need to know why they've come and what's bringing them, what is their presenting symptoms. So just in conversation, I'm going to mine information from them. As they speak, they will indicate to me what it is that they're interested in speaking about, what it is that they have on their mind, that is forefront on their mind. With dementia, with Alzheimer's, some information is not going to be available to the person. But if the person is willing to speak and wants to, whatever does come out is the issue. It is the thing they have retained. It is the thing that we're going to be discussing. And every story is going to be different, but what I do is I hear, listen to the details, and I'll find something in the details that I want to bring forward to stimulate their thoughts, stimulate what's going on with them.
Let me give you an example. I know a man who was put in the hospital because he was uncontrollable, because he has Alzheimer's, and he was put into a hospital because he was threatening to hurt his wife or hurt himself. And they put him in the hospital, and all he said is, I want to go home, I want to go home, I want to go home, I want to go home. Now, I want to go home becomes a very, very, very big message of the elderly. I want to go home. Mm-hmm. Now, there you are trying to help them out, but you know they can't go home because there is no home. What do you do?
Got to find what the things are that reminds them of home, what are the comforts that they're looking for, and try to bring that into the environment that they have to be in at that moment.
Give me an example of that.
It could be pictures. It could be a blanket from home. It could be an activity that they might have had at home that will cue them into a comfort zone. It could be family. It could be more visitations from people that are familiar that's not in the advanced stages of Alzheimer's. You have to try to rebuild the environment that they exist in currently. So home, you might think they just want to leave this location and go back to the location they came from, but home has different components to it. And if you can bring some of those components into their life, regardless of where they're at, sometimes they can gather some kind of comfort from that.
And I think by your talking about it now, but let's go just a step further. If a person has, for example, some form of dementia, and you talk to them, their attention span is very short. So then they talk to you, and then in the middle of a conversation of talking to you, they go off on a story about baseball.
Right.
What do you do?
Well, it's for me to keep track of the conversation. It's for me to, if I made a note that something was important to my client in the first 5-minute block, and then they've shifted to another topic, I'm going to keep track of it, even if they don't. So I might bring it back into the conversation. If they don't recognize that after I've brought it back in, then we'll go on to the next thing that they did bring up. And whatever they will hold on to, that'll be the focal point of trying to get some kind of comfort or relief in their life for that moment. And that's what I also try to emphasize with their family members who are in the roles of caregiver, who have noticed a decline and have some time and maybe feel motivated to step back into their elderly parents' life, that some of the methods is just for the now. It isn't for the I'm going to be here for a half an hour, I'm going to be here for 45 minutes, I'm going to be here all week long, I'm going to take off from work. And that kind of commitment can be overwhelming and cause the caregiving child to feel overwhelmed. So I go for the right now. Let's just make this five-minute block of their life qualitative right now. And then when you have more time, let's do it again for another 10 minutes. Let's do it maybe for 15 minutes. It could be as simple as going down to the cafeteria. But what I want to know is, what is the significant thing that they seem to focus on? How can we bring that back into their life no matter where they're being given care at, no matter where they're living at the moment?
It's much easier when you're not the child.
Right.
You know what I mean? When you're the offspring of this person, you have to deal with a lot of mixed feelings, don't you?
Exactly. There's a history there when your parent was vital. Maybe, given the fact that we're human beings, I'm fairly aware that it wasn't always a 1950s sitcom. I know that there were hard times. I know that there were arguments that never got resolved. I know there were times where you just stormed out and maybe you were gone. That was the day that you moved out and you didn't get back home for another year and a half, and that never was resolved. And now you have a parent who's depending on you, who's asking you that, I need you to do this for me, I want you to do that for me, and you never did this for me, so now there's guilt they're trying to put on you. It can be very, very difficult to step into a caregiving role. I'd like to address those separately with the child. I'd like for them to work on those issues so that they can be present for their parent.
So you need, if you're working with the offspring of a person who may be challenged psychologically, their mind may be going, you have to deal with the fact that they have mixed feelings.
Yes.
Among the mixed feelings is anger, disappointment, sadness, abandonment, stuff like that,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yes.
And meanwhile, they can't say it to their parents, so they get ragefully angry at their parent, and they wind up getting angry, and they just get angry and angry. And then you have one parent complaining to you about the other parent all the time, and the wife comes to you, you know what he did? He went out walking, and he wasn't wearing his clothing. And you feel this kind of mixed feelings. What you do, Alan says, come to me. I'll help you sort it out. I'm going to be able to help you separate the feelings that you have based on the resentment plus from the feelings that you have based on your desire to care. And I'm going to let you have room to vent these feelings, you know, to be able to work with them so that they could be sorted through, so that when you approach cleanly.
Do you ever do any sort of work with the parent and the children and some modeling of how to interact and talk to people with Alzheimer's? Because it does become different, right?
Right. The parent themselves, they're already in the stage where they're not retaining the information. So a lot of times you have to take the parent for who they are now. And a lot of the work is done with the children. A lot of the work is done with the caregiver. So it's the caregiver's challenge to try to make a distinction between the person that they are and affected by the past of this adult parent and the needs, the care that they can give now. Separate themselves from the person that was wounded by the parent, possibly, have hurt feelings from the parent. Separate that from the adult that you are now, who can give what your parent needs now. You have some key information that your parent needs that you can give. If you can separate that person that can do this from that other person who is affected, hurt, resentful, angry, holding on to feelings.
But what Stephanie is asking as well is, can you get them both in the same room to help them negotiate at least a communication style?
Yes, you can always, if you're in, say, a nursing home setting.
Well, let's say you're in an office setting. Can you bring your parent?
Yes.
You bring your parent to your therapist and say, okay, we're going to sit down and talk, and that person may not be very capable. Have you had this experience with families Stephanie?
Yes, many people don't know what to do when they're presented with someone who is very different than the person that they knew, is very different than, you know, how we used to talk about the New York Times headlines. All of a sudden, you know, you don't know what the New York Times headlines are.
Right.
So what do we talk about? And sometimes it's helpful to have that modeled for you by a professional who knows, who can also say, okay, look, now you could tell your mom's comfortable, you know, or you could tell that she's present right now.
Right. So then
maybe.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So you're modeling how to conversate with this new person who is your parent. And you as the child are watching that interaction, so you'll know how to step in when the professional is not there.
Right.
That makes perfect sense. You just want to do more modeling than you do want to settle issues between the elderly parent who might not be present a lot and the child. That kind of work needs to be done with the child, probably exclusively, because if you have a confused parent who is responsible for a lot of the issues that the child has, the child may want to confront the parent, and the parent's not going to be able to respond or resolve anything for the child at that moment.
Right, right. That's, yeah, I was talking more about how to have a new relationship with this parent who is presenting to you as someone different than you knew her to be.
And it's important to realize that the attention span is going to be shorter for the elderly parent. So if you're looking at a 40-minute model or a 45-minute model to have the parent and the child, you might be 15 or maybe 10 minutes in, and then the parent is just, I want to go home. You know, where's my coffee? And they're no longer even engaged in any kind of session. Now they're bored. Now they're restless. Sometimes you just have to address that. And if you've brought the parent to the office, you're faced with a dilemma of what do you do with the parent while you have another 30 minutes for the session. I really want to work with you on what we discussed last week, but your mom is really agitated at this moment. Let's not exacerbate what's going on with her. Let's try to get her some comfort real quick. So I like the idea more of going to where the parent is rather than bringing the parent into the therapeutic atmosphere. I like going to where the parent is so that if they need relief after 10 minutes or 15 minutes, they can go directly to it. They can go back to their bed, or they can go back to the day room for where there's television or an activity, and then you can work again with the child.
Well, let me ask you something, Alan. Have you ever met an agitated person with dementia who you couldn't calm down in a few minutes?
Oh, yes. Yes.
You just couldn't, right?
Right. And what you
with all your skills. I mean, you're a really skilled guy, and you've got all that, you know, you're a wonderful man, you have a charm, you have a way of making people know that. I don't mean that as a compliment.
Right.
I mean, it's as a
skill set.
A skill set. You have that stuff. I'm trying to just think. I mean, you've worked with more of this than I have. How agitated can a person get, and what would it take you within 15 minutes to calm somebody down?
Well, then it becomes a matter of managing the environment around the agitated person. There are many times where you just cannot be the solution for that agitation. That's not going to go away. So you have to modify the environment. You have to make sure that there aren't dangerous things available to be grabbed. You have to make sure that you yourself are safe. You have to make sure that anyone in the area is safe.
Oh.
And then you just have to wait it out. You have to ride out the agitation.
This is Armand DeMille. My guests are Stephanie Roth and Alan White. We're talking about dealing with people who are parents and grandmothers, because we try to... It's beautiful to love your parents. You know, it's a really beautiful thing to be able to love them even as they get older, and it's so hard to lose them to dementia and things. So we'll be back with you in a couple of minutes, my friends. A little music for you.
In my mother's house, there's a photograph of an income path. Oh, it makes me laugh. There's a little girl, wary of the world. She got much to learn. Get her fingers. And it feels easy between you and
Corinne
Bailey Ray.
Corinne Bailey Ray. Butterfly. Hey, want to hear history about music? That's an interesting thing. Alan, right? Mm-hmm. And both Alan and Stephanie, we say, all right, I want to play something about parents, and both of them pop off with this song. But then, Alan, you have a history of listening to music on WBAI and the Positive Mind. I want to get what you said before.
Right.
Because there's a whole bunch of people who say, why does he play music?
The content of your show is excellent, bar none. But I always loved the new music breaks as well. There I can't remember anything that you've played in the interstitial that I thought, what? Because I always loved it. I loved your taste. I love your taste of music.
And what happens is just exactly what you watched as you watch me go through the procedure here. I search, Stephanie Dombra, who's my associate who does most of the engineering with me, and I will search for what we're looking for. What are we're going to find the music that's going to go with everything. And it goes with a feeling as well as it goes with a kind of a reflection of the mood. So I have a whole bunch of people out there as an audience who says, will you please get rid of that music so that we could just talk straight through and listen to your program? And I can't. I need that thing in the middle for me. I need to have it. This is Armand DeMille, WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial in New York City. We are here on this special day after Christmas, middle of many celebrations. And we're talking about loving and finding compassion for that group of people who have come before us, the generations. I had this realization the other day, since I grew up in the 50s, where I was living with, and with most jazz musicians, we were kind of living together. We were on the same block, the same neighborhood. Everybody was right there across the street on 6th Street and 2nd Avenue in Manhattan. And I realized the other day, I was talking to Kent Robert Shaw, who's a psychiatrist, jazz aficionado, that most of the people I admired when I was young were about musicians who were 25 years old, about 25 jazz musicians. Now, if they were 25 in 1960, that would make them 47 years older now. That would make them 72. Now, most musicians I know never made it to 72 because their livers wouldn't hold out, their kidneys wouldn't hold out, their stomachs wouldn't hold out. There was no such thing as nutrition. You ate whatever you could eat. You got beaten up significantly, and there were enough scars. You just had to get by. Nobody I knew expected to live after 50. In the famous words of one of my friends, he said, if I would have known I was going to live this long, I would have flossed. Right? So the fact that many people now are getting on to these ages that we haven't seen before, in numbers that we haven't seen before. Now we have people in their 70s and 80s, and then we have people in their 60s, and then we have people in their 40s, and then people in their 20s, who are all functioning adults.
Four generations.
Four generations at the same time being here, and of course they have children too, but they're all functioning adults and they're rubbing elbows.
No.
So I meet someone younger than I am. I have a good friend, Michael Jessen. I have you, Stephanie Roth. I have people who are young and new, and I see the excitement of their learning, and I love it. And I love their minds. I love how flexible they are and how fast the mind moves, and that's one. And then I meet somebody older than me, and they've got this jewel of a perception of the world. What I'm hoping that everybody can do is access all the generations and appreciate everything for the learning level that it's at.
Right.
And how do we do that? How are we going to get there? We need to understand. Let's jump in and start to understand Alzheimer's, because it's good to catch it before the mind really falls. I want to get a little understanding of Alzheimer's, maybe not so much as a diagnosis, but people know what we're talking about. Alan, give me an introduction to it.
Well, Alzheimer's is named after the man who first had noticed this in 1901, I do believe. And there was an autopsy done on the first patient that he thought may have been suffering from a disease that was theretofore undiagnosed. The autopsy showed that the brain had shrunken a great deal, and there were buildup of some type of protein that is now called amyloids. And so early detection of Alzheimer's is being done currently by doing a scan of people who are at risk that may have a parent, grandparent, aunts, or uncles who has suffered from Alzheimer's, and they might be at a genetic risk for it. If they volunteered themselves, they can take a compound that will highlight these protein buildups, see if they're growing or seeing if they have more than an average brain scan, and possibly give the warning to the person that might be facing Alzheimer's, but also collecting data for the companies to now begin research. Well, the research has begun, but to step up the research with a realistic scope that so many people in our society are looking at possibly suffering from this disease in the future. And there's a very telling statistic here that says, let me see if I can find it.
The amyloid hypothesis, by the way, I just wanted to take you to one place with it. Let me ask you a question about that. I'll do that. The question is that is Alzheimer's and dementia, how are they different?
Well, the difference is dementia have symptoms that come with aging, common aging, but Alzheimer's can onset in the 50s, if not the 60s. It doesn't have to be something that comes because a person is 70 or 80 years old, and it has physical symptoms that are detectable, unfortunately, after there's death and after there's an autopsy, that you can tell that this was Alzheimer's. There are these amyloid buildups that have interrupted the brain functioning, the firing of the neurons.
So it's if a person is diagnosed with Alzheimer's early on, you might be able to do treatment. We do know certain things that we've learned from neuroscience that seems to be some early treatment, and we're saying that the earlier the treatment, the earlier the diagnosis is, the more perhaps we'll be able to treat
it. More perhaps.
I remember the Brain Mind program that I've been working on and a couple of others that have been available, which are building the brain cells, which are really kind of remarkable. You're being able to build new neurons, which is kind of remarkable.
That would go a long way.
You know, it goes an awful long way. But the trouble with it is that we don't have to do that. We also found that some long-range studies have shown that people who are who do exercise one day, every day, if they exercise or they get out of their house and they walk 1 mile, they have as much brain growth as people who do these focused programs. So it's giving us two things. Imagine doing both.
Well, isn't it also true? I've heard a lot about word games and playing.
Yeah, that's what we're talking about,
games.
Sure.
As well, which is a sort of brain exercise as well as walking.
There are more specific ones. There's a couple that are put out by Posit Science that we offered during our fundraising here at WBAI, which is really more specific, building certain areas of the brain, very specific. You're right. Any brain exercise is good, but they say the crossword puzzles and things like that don't do the right development. They help you stay off, but they don't help you develop. However, Alzheimer is the leading cause of dementia, you know, and 5 million people in the United States have Alzheimer's. Most of them are over 65. It's the nation's sixth leading death cause of death by disease, sixth leading, kills nearly 66,000 people a year. By 2050, according to the Alzheimer's Association, 11 million to 16 million Americans will have the disease. Now, that means that we're going to have a culture of people with Alzheimer's who are going to be not just sick, they're going to be manageable. and it's going to be a management thing. And so there's going to be a group of people out there who are not going to be in homes, who are not going to be put away. They're going to be taught how to function. They will have shorter memory spans. They will have short attention spans. And they're not going to, you may at first, you'll make fun of them, but eventually, give us the time, we are going to accept this as part of our culture if we can't cure it. It's like trying to accept toddlers, you know?
Right.
We accept toddlers because they can't walk. We accept people at a certain age instead of putting them out on the ice and saying you're no good for anything anymore. We're going to find a way to use each person to give their contribution of what they have and accept them in our lives.
We're on the beginning of doing that with the caregivers, with the children of parents who are like that now. Those, after their parent has succumbed to mortality, they'll have all those skills still in place. And then they'll be going into their elderly years knowing how to train other people to do the same. And I think a lot of people will be motivated because it was so soothing for their soul to be able to help their parent through that difficult time. They'll want to share it. I think I believe a lot in the human spirit in that capacity, where they will share it with their neighbor. They will give their story to someone else, and that'll inspire someone else. I think the culture you're talking about is going to spawn that supportive system around that population.
Alan, the when a person has, if a person has Alzheimer's, is it likely, is it genetic? Do they find a genetic connection between the potential for Alzheimer's?
Yes, they found that a daughter, not so much by gender, but just by one or two generations, it can, the pattern has been there in many, many families. And they are bringing the children, maybe they're in their 40s now, the children of an Alzheimer's patient, they're asking them to be tested in this way to see if they can start doing early detection. And they're going by genetic lines. That's how they are counting on being able to treat it.
Do you know how you get tested? I guess you've got it's quite an extraordinary thing, isn't it? They do brain mapping and stuff?
Yes, they do brain mapping. There's a compound that they put in, and that compound shows up on brain scans that will highlight these amyloid deposits.
Is it easily accessible, or is it something you have to go to special labs for? I mean,
no, it takes a special situation. You have,
And is it affordable?
That is the question right there. It will become more affordable when the awareness of the need for early detection is more emphasized in our society. You know, right now, it's all about the profit margin, and if the testers and the people that make this chemical compound and the people that maintain the facilities, if they're making their profit margin behind this, then they can be managed. But I don't think right now it's in place where they see the value that they can fund these things and get reimbursed. So I think it's pretty costly.
So the people who are getting the testing probably have the money to afford to get the testing, therefore probably are not the people who are suffering.
Right.
And probably have, you know, and therefore it takes care of itself like we tend to do. Right?
Right.
Keep the good folks going and the hell with all those other people, right?
So much in society, you know, you just want to address and correct.
when a parent has dementia, if a child is watching one parent with dementia, what are the odds of the other parent getting dementia? Do you know? And what's it like to watch your second parent get dementia when you're...
Right. It's very taxing.
This happens frequently.
Well, it's been studied. There are cases. It isn't necessarily the actual disease of Alzheimer's because it's not contagious. So the married parent won't be getting it through contact. But it can be just the stress of having 24 hours a day your loved one leaving you and declining in their personality, so that you are faced with that kind of stress. And a lot of times the compensation for 24-hour, 7-day-a-week stress is to dissociate. And your brain will try to repair itself from the stress by withdrawing a little bit from what's going on. So it's almost like the reaction to trauma, when your partner of 40 years is leaving you, even though their body is there. So apart from your children or apart from your society, you're living with somebody who you're losing, and there's an entire grief process that you're experiencing, and untreated, that can cause a lot of decline on your own.
So if we have somebody like you who is the, who you're the aide to the person who is married to or living with the person who's going through it, you're going to help them go through their feelings rather than them bury them and dissociate, in which way, which would encourage them to have their own form of dementia.
Right.
Right? Because you watch one parent, you know, gone, and you watch the other parents slowly losing their mind.
Right.
That second parent's help, how essential it is for the entire family and the children and the children's children.
Yes.
That the parent of the partner gets help.
Right.
You must get help.
Right.
For yourself.
And that's when a family system is so vital to the health of everyone who is not stricken with Alzheimer's. That's when the children can support that parent and give them the kind of support that they need when they're at their wit's end, when their husband or their wife has wandered out of the house for the 15th time that day, and they just don't know how to cope with this. Instead of the children saying, well, Dad will just take care of that, Dad's always taking care of things, it's time for the children to kind of marshal their support back again to the home and be there for that dad and say, maybe we'll take some turns, we'll do some cycles, we'll be there on Tuesday and you can take a breather. But to definitely acknowledge that the so-called healthy parent, you know, just in perspective, that healthy parent needs to have an outlet as well. And if they're not coming to a professional, then they can at least get it from the society.
Well, what happens with most people is that you wind up calling your children, saying to your children, you know what Dad did? And you know what the child does? The child takes shots from where they are, you know? Well, then lock him in his room.
Right.
Well, then call the police.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then... And the children try to find, out of their own anger and disappointment and frustration, they give advice. Now, it is highly, I know this, in treating people and working with people, when you give advice to a caregiver who is become a caretaker of somebody with Alzheimer's, they don't listen to advice. They don't follow. They don't go to the groups. Do you know why? What is it that keeps them from following? Or is it just that they become immune to advice? What happens?
It might be,
you've seen
that, stubbornness,
right?
And it might be a stubbornness to not want to give in to the defeat of, I need a bigger system to support us. It might just be exactly what maybe the children might be thinking. I've taken care of this person. When I married them, I pledged that I would take care of this person. They need me. I'm going to be the one to take care of this person. And not give in to, let me take some help for the both of us.
I think, you know, part of what you said and part of probably what happens is you get to a point where you have this choice. In order for you to properly take care of the person, you have to face yourself.
Every time.
You know, and if you don't want to, if you get so externalized by taking care of other people, you just get so removed from yourself. You're so focused on the sick person that the threat of facing yourself, your own inadequacies, your own pain, your own fear, looms like it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Therefore, any advice that you are giving for psychological relief is like saying, you know that wound that you have on your arm that's infected? We got to cut it open with a knife to let it bleed in order to let the wound get fresh again. We got to open it up. And the person just more and more decides, oh, yeah, may say to you, yeah, I know I should call. Yes, I know I should join the group. Yes, I know. But they become immune to you, the advice giver, too. When you find that you're giving advice to empty ears, don't think the person is fighting against you. Just see that their pain has built up to such a point that they can't handle it anymore.
Right.
And there's got to be another end run. There's got to be another way around.
Find another way in.
You know, and that's what you do. My guests have been my researcher, co-host today is Stephanie Roth, who's a psychotherapist and has worked with parents and families and generations and work a lot. You work a lot with young people, too, right? You know?
Yes.
Their perception of older people, what are they... How do the young people nowadays see the older people? Are they so removed, or are they at all?
I think there's two parts of society. I think there's a part that's very removed, and then there's a whole different part where now it's very common for grandparents to live really close by and have both parents work. So after school, people go to their grandparents' house, or grandma's there to take care of the kids. So there's those kinds of families who's very close, who's very protective over their grandparents and don't see such a generational gap because they're there all the time. And then I think there's others who are very removed who, you know, maybe my family lives in New York and my grandparents live in Texas. So I don't really see my grandparents very often. In fact, if they were ill, I might not know because I don't have a relationship
with
them.
But people have more and more relationships with their grandparents now because of, number one, they're living longer.
They're living longer.
And that they help bring you up.
Yes.
You know, sometimes the grandparent is more of a parent than your parents.
Right, which you see also a lot in single-parent homes where they utilize the support of their mother or their father who's in the neighborhood.
Great. Stephanie Roth, thank you very much. Alan White, thank you very much.
Thank you, Alan.
You're going to be back with us many times, I am sure.
I look forward to it.
Yeah, this is fun, huh?
Yes.
Thank you both for being here. We will be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m., my friends. This is Armand DeMille with you, and... if you want to look at our website, thepositivemind.com, and if you want to get in touch with Alan or Stephanie, you could do it through my office at 212-757-4488, and we'll get to both of them. That's 212-757-4488. Back with you tomorrow, my friends.
In church on Sunday morning, Grandma's hand played a tambourine so well. Grandma's hand used to issue out a warning. She'd say, Billy, don't you run so fast. Might fall on a piece of glass. Might be snakes there in that grass. That's